Okay, we talked last Wednesday about, spent some time talking about this organization issue and the culminating in the American Christian Missionary Society, which was an issue that would plague the churches that we've been talking about out of the Restoration Movement for 50 years. They'd be debating it. But that in and of itself did not cause the split that we're kind of familiar with from the standpoint of looking back over history now and what would turn into the churches of Christ and the Christian church primarily. There were a number of other issues that came on the scene as well throughout this period that were issues of debate among the brethren. Now, I hope I don't lose my voice. And those, some of these we've talked a little bit about, been introduced anyway, because of the impacts it had upon the various issues being discussed at the time. While they might not have directly been being debated, they did have an influence, and primarily among those was slavery, the issue of slavery. And what happened in the case of slavery before the war, the Civil War, you had slavery being debated, you know, people taking views, and they're generally personal views. Do I support slavery or do I not support slavery? And they did not particularly have arguments going on within congregations. In fact, there were efforts made to teach. Major reason for this is the Bible doesn't take a particular stand on endorsing or refuting slavery. In fact, the Bible is more involved in spiritual condition rather than your life condition. So the issue did not get a lot of debate in terms of the various papers we've talked about are within congregations. And as it got closer to the war, there were actually there's a lot of discussion within churches trying to keep unity within the church, within that congregation over this subject, not have it break things up. There were some impacts. We mentioned this when we talked about the some of the meetings of the American Christian Missionary Society, where you did not have representations during the war. You did not have representation from churches that were in the South. They were part of that, and there were proposals, resolutions to have the people that are represented there support the existing government, i.e. the Union side, in the conflict. And that caused some problems. But by and large, both north, the north-south border states where congregations existed, they worked hard to keep unity and not have this subject divide them. And so when you come out on the other end of the Civil War, whereas you had breaks in denominations, like Baptist denomination, where you would have the northern the American Baptist something, and the Southern Baptist Convention and other Baptist organizations come out of that war. You did not have that kind of split come out of the war among those who were had been in the group of Christians that followed the Stone Campbell movement of the time. And so that's a little different than others, and in part probably contributed to the growth, the fairly rapid growth following the war, of the congregations of the Churches of Christ and Christian Church. There was another issue, and this may have it may have some connection with coming out of denominationalism, and only in this sense that communion was viewed in the denominations as a sacrament, and that would have a little bit of an impact, I think, maybe in people's background thinking. But there was an issue of open or closed communion, and there are two views taken. One is that you should invite, whether people were immersed, I'll call it, quote, immersed Christians, unquote, or non-immersed Christians, quote, unquote, whether or not these should be, and the non-immersed should be invited in to participate in communion. And then the other end of that was to have a closed communion where you did not allow, you did not actively invite, and you would go all the way to the point of controlling who was allowed to partake of the Lord's Supper. And that was the closed communion. And that debate went on, but by and large, where the vast majority of these congregations came down was to let it be a personal decision. They did not actively solicit, nor did they refuse. And not unlike what you're accustomed to, it was, you know, people are going to have to make, people who are in the audience, who are in the auditorium in our case, the meeting house, would have to make that decision when the offering, the Lord's Supper was offered. And that's where the vast majority of these groups came. So it did not result in a split either. The third one was a located preacher issue, and this was a bigger, maybe a bigger issue than that I would have thought and you may have thought. When you started out, these groups that had preachers that were associated with churches, in a lot of cases, early on, of course, they did a lot of circuit preaching. Certain men did. But there were men that would be located in a particular area, and they were expected to get their living off the farm or some other means than church support. So they were physically located, but they were not located in the sense of being person who worked with a particular congregation was supported by the congregation. And one of the fears, and this, again, this is one of those things that comes out of the denominational background probably, one of the fears was that if they were supported, they would turn into clergy. And you have that old clergy, which of course, one of the things that the Stone Campbell groups tried to move away from and brought about the Reformation. Gradually, over time, this changed. Preachers started being supported by congregations. And this was an issue that in and of itself did not cause these groups to split into separate bodies. I hate to use the word not denominations, but people that believe one way, associated with one way versus the other. But it would be additive when this question of instrumental music came along. Part of the reason was what would become the Christian church had fallen into calling their preachers, these located preachers, pastors. And so, you know, those who did not agree with it were seeing it as literally going back to a clergy class. And so this would be, just would add fuel to the fire when you had a discussion about instrumental music versus non-instrumental, or just vocal music, and because the Christian church, those who would take up instrumental music, use of that, were the very same ones that would call their preachers reverend or pastor. And so it just helped along the way, helped to split along the way. So those are at least three issues that were active on top of the organizational issues of the day and what we're going to talk about now, instrumental music. the instrumental music thing, we go back to the first 20 years, 25 years, I suppose, of this restoration movement. And this subject wasn't being talked about. It wasn't until 1851, as I mentioned in your notes there, that the first discussion came up. And it came up because somebody wrote a letter. And what intrigued me about a quote out of this letter that I put in your lesson, where it says, "Brother Henshaw, what say you of instrumental music in our churches?" Look at the last sentence of that, of his question. We are far in the rear of the Protestants on the subject of church music. I just, when I read that, it brought a thought back to my mind. Recall when Samuel was confronted with the people. What are the people, this was in 1 Samuel 8, if you want to reflect on it, what do the people want? They were unsatisfied with Samuel, right? They wanted a king. We want to be like the nations around us. And so they wanted a king to judge them, a king to lead them, a king to take them into battle, whatever the case might be. And there's a little bit of what's going on here, not wanting a king, obviously, but you look around, and everybody, not everybody else, all these denominations may have instrumental music, a bunch of them do, and shouldn't we have that? Wouldn't it make our service better? A fellow now named Rogers, who was a co-editor of the Christian Messenger, Associate of Stone, wrote Campbell and asked his opinion when this came up. And Campbell made a statement, wrote in opposition, and he said, "I presume to all spiritually minded Christians, such aids would be as a cowbell in a concert." 2 points to make from that. One, after he said that, they didn't even talk about this issue for the next 10 years. And that gives you a sense of how influential Campbell was. He just made a statement, a very critical statement, and that had an impact. But the other thing that struck me when I read this is he uses a term or association. He associates a word with this instrumental music issue. I don't know if you picked it up. "I presume to all spiritually minded Christians such aids would be as a cowbell in a concert." How did he view, based on that, how did he view instrumental music?
As an aid.
As an aid. Okay, and this is a big issue. This is a fundamental issue. It's not an aid, which we'll talk about later. So this thing sat still around 1860 or so, you had a fellow that preached at in a church in Midway, Kentucky, and the singing apparently was pretty poor. He used the term that it would scare even the rats from worship, and so they didn't do too well. So somebody had the idea to bring in a melodeon, and they would. First they had the idea, let's get together and practice our singing, which they did. They started meeting on Saturdays, and then somebody brought a melodeon in to help set the pitch. They didn't have pitch pipes back in those days, so they'd bring a whole melodeon in. And so they brought it in, and that was intent, was just to get the right pitch. And they practiced. Well, then a lady knew how to play this thing, and she sat down and started playing along. I say she sat down, she was asked to, I suppose. And she accompanied the singing with their playing. She accompanied their singing with her playing. And so from that, they liked it enough to move it into their Sunday worship. And so that's how, and reflect again, I pointed this out to you on many occasions before, just as a generic way things get started. Was it bad to have a singing practice? Anything wrong with that? Was it wrong to have a melodeon to set a pitch or a pitch pipe and go on and do your singing? And the problem is, this is not unlike what we've seen so many times before. There's some innocent kind of reason for something that evolves into something much more serious. Remember our friend Eve and Satan. What did God tell Eve and Adam if would happen if they partook of the fruit of the forbidden fruit?
They should surely die.
Okay, they should surely die. What did Satan say?
You won't die.
One word he injected. And I said, not surely die. And that's how it's set. You know, things can be very subtle. And not big changes, which is kind of the way this is. Not big change, little change. Well, then it evolved into something else. And so it was brought into this church. It's interesting historically that one of the elders and a slave pulled the thing out through a back window somewhere and eventually returned it. But I mean, they were upset. There were some people who were upset about this, but it continued. And I've given you a quote of Pinkerton, the preacher there, which is, I think, a very telling quote. So far as is known to me, I'm the only preacher in Kentucky of our brotherhood who has publicly advocated the propriety of employing instrumental music in some churches, and that the Church of God in Midway is the only church that has yet made a decided effort to introduce it. What does John 2:16 say? What are the things of the world?
1 John, you mean?
I mean 1 John, sorry. Thank
the
you.
Lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life.
And the boastful pride of life. You read this, and you tell me if there's not that aspect in this. I want to be like people around me. That's one thought. I want to be like the others around us. And in this guy's case, it seemed to be, I want to be a liberal. This guy, I want to be a leader. This guy, by the way, the historians say Pinkerton was one of the quote liberals of the Brotherhood at the time, unquote. So you liberal being in this case, moving out beyond what the Word of God said. So that was in 1860. This thing sat around for a while. And 1860, 1861, and then 3 or 4 years later, you started to have enough extended discussion, enough issues going on around the quote brotherhood. You started having some extended discussion of it, and Millennial Harbinger being one that started out. And generally speaking, although Pendleton, that you know, he'd come out and say, and this is absolutely true, that there's no scriptural basis for this particular innovation. He didn't think that it was a question of anything other than a mere expediency, matter of opinion. And so from the get-go on this, you'll find that people, as they debated this issue, didn't debate it from a scriptural standpoint. They never tried to justify it on a scriptural standpoint. And he didn't either. Everybody acknowledged the fact that instrumental music was not something that was practiced in the first century. That wasn't even part of the debate. Pendleton himself would come out a lot stronger in resisting in the writings, resisting this, writing against it, but he always, I guess to the day he died, maintained it was still a matter of opinion. He just had to be strongly against it. He had a couple other guys, one of which we talked about, McGarvey, who was very much against instrumental music. He had Hayden that wasn't. And Hayden would say it was a matter of expediency, and he would maintain the silence of the scriptures was not sufficient ground for rejecting it. In other words, the silence of the scriptures said you could do it, because it didn't say anything about it. And McGarvey, of course, took the other side and was quite outspoken about it. And so now we're in the middle of the Civil War. We come out of the Civil War. And you start to have, toward the end of that, you have Lord, who we're familiar with, who is very much an outspoken critic. And he would write, I won't use the word volumes, but he'd write frequently against it. And, you know, his writings were on the basis of it of it not being scriptural, and of a recognition this is instrumental music, not simply an aid. And, you know, he made these strong statements, and I think we hit on these when we were talking about Lark, that, you know, he was calling for people to, preachers never to enter into a congregation, never involve themselves with a congregation and practice this, and that Christians should never be members of a congregation that practice this. And if somebody, you know, the majority somehow gets an organ inside the congregation the person's involved with, the Christian's involved with, they ought to get up and leave and go someplace else. And so that was his advice repeatedly made. And so by 1868, so we started off 1850, it had never been talked about it. By 1868, there still weren't but about 50 churches out of 10,000 congregations that had this instrument. But as, you know, as these things happened, it started to grow. And it would grow pretty rapidly after that. So 1870 and beyond, it was getting pretty influential. And what you find is that this practice tended to grow fastest in urban settings. And if you go back to the one of the earlier statements about this writer made about we want to be like, you know, indicating they want to be like the ones around them. Well, you get into an urban setting where you've got all these other churches and people and generally worldly people involved in activities. Those who were Christians were getting influenced by that, and they wanted to be like, these churches wanted to be like those around them, and compete, in essence. And so this is where you tended to find this happening most rapidly. And this fellow Franklin, made an observation, and that is the accompaniment of lifeless, formal, and fashionable circles in cities where pride, aristocracy, and selfishness prevail, where the poor have no sympathy, comfort, and place. Our place. That was where the music would show up. So he was, you know, he was pretty critical of people. So when it came to the instrumental music, and how did people try to defend this? You know, we've talked in the past, it's come up before about, well, when some of these things came up, what were the scriptural arguments going on? Well, here's this one. And what's interesting about this one is there were no scriptural arguments early on. Early on, the whole support of instrumental music was because it helped the singing. That was the argument. I've already showed you that the people of the time, they did not try to say that this was something that was practiced in the first century. There's no way they could say that because it's not true. And they knew it wasn't true. And so the attempts to justify instrumental music on the basis of scriptural grounds would only come later, much later. And there's some other scriptural grounds that people try to use that we've been exposed to since that developed outside of this period. Trying to argue on the Greek.
So when Lard stood against it, you know, and what his message was, forsake unity. You know, this unity thing had been going on, you know, no matter what up here. And then forsake unity, stand for, and, you know, in my note I put truth, but evidently it's just stand for because of what he believed or because it was the truth.
On Lard?
On Lard.
Because it was
he said, you know, let brethren and let preachers who go into there, you know, take a stand. You know, don't even be there.
Well, because truth had no foundation in scripture.
Okay, so he was standing for scripture.
Yeah, Lard.
Lard.
Yes.
Okay.
Here are your arguments that are used. That would be used in this sometime after this, as the people tried to justify it. One is, you know, the old mechanicals, they had mechanical instruments in the Old Testament. Valid, they did. And that's accurate.
It's interesting, well, they had it in the Old Testament, they got a New Testament, and the eight passages just say, instrument, why did they have, in any fashion, any mention of with musical instruments?
Boy, yeah, absolutely. Of course, we're not under the Old Testament, under the Old Covenant. Christ nailed that one to the cross, this in Colossians. And you know, the whole book of Hebrews deals with the Christ and his function. And in the course of that, points out that the first covenant was obsolete, second covenant's in play. And so we're not under that. And this argument won't fly today, particularly. And maybe it's a good time to talk about that Wednesday. But if that's your justification, well, God demanded priests, right, in the Old Testament. Where are the priests as part of worship? God demanded sacrifice. Where is that a part of worship? God allowed polygamy. That's not part of worship. God allowed polygamy in the Old Testament. So should we practice polygamy because God allowed it? So, you know, the argument falls flat on its face, and a weak argument anyway. I don't know if people would ever argue this seriously now, other than the fact that we're trying to justify. A lot of times we try to justify what we believe on the basis of false thinking. The other argument was it's an expedient, and this is probably the one that's used the most. And so the arguments that these are aids or expediency to carrying out the command to sing. And as is pointed out, but instrumental music is, in fact, a form of music. It's played on a mechanical device. Singing is likewise a form of music. It's also executed on a device. It's not an organic device. It's not a mechanical device. You know, lungs, mouth, vocal cords, etc. So it's two distinct types of music. It's not one's not an aid to the other. And so we have gave you examples you're very familiar with. That you have David in the ark substituting the cart for what God had specified. And you know the results of that. David learned his lesson. And there's another issue around aids in a generic sense, and that is, you know, you can ask the question, okay, when are aids not authorized? If you want to make the argument this is an aid. And there are times when aids are not authorized. When would they be? Can you think of one where any kind of aid is not authorized? I mean, can you think of that? Suppose I want to make a lousy example. Let me just illustrate. Mechanical music is not authorized. How about mechanical music as in a piano? How about I bring in a set of drums to aid my piano? I need the beat, right? But if the piano's not authorized, what's the basis for the aid? It's not authorized either. So if you got an aid, if you got a practice that's not authorized, well, then any aid in support of that is not going to be authorized. That's one factor. Second factor is when you substitute one thing for another, i.e. David example, the ark example. Cart was substituted for sons of Kohath carrying it on their shoulders. If you think about this, David recognizes this and he takes the action to line up the Kohathites, and they get all their stuff together, get their act together, go out, and then you get the ark and start carrying it on the poles like they're supposed to do. Are they fulfilling God's work? Okay. Now they're making the trip back to Jerusalem, and they get tired. And there happened to be some guys from Gershon walking alongside. Tribe of Levi, right? God had work for them to do. So they were holy men. And these Kohathites say, can y'all just give us a hand here? It's getting, things getting heavy. And so you got four Gershonites that get under the poles with the Kohathites. What have they done?
They've added.
The other one substitutes cart for the right way. And this is, you know, he's still doing the right thing, right? Kohathites. But now we've added. We've brought in some people. And so, you know, when you look at what's authorized and these issues around expediency, you go back and test clearly. Try to understand clearly what we're talking about. Are we talking about what God's authorized? Are we adding to it? Or are we substituting to it? And those are just tests to be put to issues when we're talking about authorization of things.
So,
you know,
is the key what we've talked about many times, and where we have a specific command, when we deviate from that and substitute from that, that's where we are. But when there's that general, just the whole specific versus general thing.
No, not so much. I wouldn't say. I mean, it can be, but. You know, if you think about the old generic of gold that was given to the apostles, and we use that one as an example, we can go any way you want to go. I mean, there is no limit that I know of. I wish I hadn't thought about it. So you go by cart, go by horse, donkey, mule, go any way you want to go. When it comes to, let's see, I'm terrible about thinking on my feet. See if I can come up with a better example, maybe an illustration. God, you know, we have authority for teaching, correct? We have authority for assembly. You see that? Well, what do we assemble in?
A building.
So we have authority for a building. Now, do we have authority in the course of that building issue of renting a building or buying a building?
Yes.
Okay, now, because we have authority for buildings, can we now buy a building and rent it out? And, oh, that works pretty well. We don't use our parking lot all the time. Can we take and rent out our parking lot on Monday, Tuesday? Well, say up to 5 o'clock every day of the week except Sunday. So we have authority for a parking lot, but do we have authority now to rent it out? And that's where people don't walk through that kind of logic. That's, I think, the kind of thing that will get people doing things. You can look at the underlying thought process, or not thought process, but you can put them.
Yeah, but you always got to tie it back to the specific example or command we see in the New Testament of a symbol. You always got to make that root. This is what we're focused on.
But this is an incidental. Mm-hmm. See, I'm just going to rent out the parking lot incidentally.
Well, yeah, that's how people justify, right? It's just a little change. It's no big deal. Usually it's positive.
Yeah.
But once you make the first one, where does it stop? Right. Well, you can do the same thing for collecting money, you know.
Yep.
We're commanded to collect, but people add to that all the time. They have bake sales, they have fundraisers, you know, they collect on other days of the week besides Sunday.
The meet on days besides me and Lou up Sunday.
Well, and so that's a question you can ask. You know, we're commanded to assemble, but we're not limited to assembling. We're commanded to assemble. It's not specified what day of the week we're commanded to assemble. It is specified what day of the week we're commanded to partake of the Lord's Supper and assembly, and that is the first day of the week. So that's why we get together on Wednesday, you know, or any other day of the week.
We could meet as a congregation of people 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm. And they did in Acts.
Right? Yeah. There's no problem with that. And the question is, what do you do those 7 days a week? Would we be authorized to have the Lord's Supper 7 days a week? It's a good thing to have Lord's Supper, isn't it? Mm-hmm. See, so it's those kind of things. So I don't know that you can make going back to your original comment. I don't know if it answers your question. I'm not sure the question you were asking, I answer right. But people, you know, look, fundamentally, I run the risk of painting with a very broad brush when I make this statement, so just bear that in mind. One of the problems we run into, we as people, generally speaking, is we want to do what we want to do. Just that fundamentally simple. Let me ask you a question. We're coming out of Egypt. We're part of the nation of Israel. We're coming out of Egypt. We cross the Red Sea. We look at all this stuff that's gone on before us. These plagues that have happened. Are we impressed by God's power? Do we know there's a God?
Yes.
Well, we should.
Do we know there's a yeah, as people, though, was there ample evidence?
We've seen the evidence.
See it clearly. So what do we do while Moses is not among us?
Build a
golden calf. Now, how do you explain that?
You know, but to play devil's advocate, the golden calf was the substitute for God. They said, this is the God that delivered us out of Egypt.
You know, was it?
It was not. But it's what, you know, yeah, it's what they perceived as.
It's what they want. It's what they were used to doing.
It's what they wanted to make their God that brought them out of Egypt.
So be a devil's advocate, but you're just making the point. It's what they wanted to do.
Well, I'm explaining the justification.
You can't justify. That's the point.
They obviously get justified because they
in their mind.
Sure.
But then you can, yeah, if you want to say, can I justify it from the standpoint of self? Sure. Can I justify it in God's eyes? No way. That's
well,
the
I'm
problem.
I'm just trying to help you make your point that people.
You did a good job of it.
Yeah.
Very good job of it. But then, you know, the reason I say it's a broad brush, and I got to be careful about that. You know, there are people on other issues. They're good. They have good and honest hearts. I'm not trying to cast that dispersion on not having that. They can just be mistaken. What I'm saying, as a general rule, a lot of times you see these quote innovations come about because people want to do what people want to do, and this is not a new problem. I mean, you go back to Adam and Eve. You know, that for whatever reason, or maybe Cain and Abel would be a better example. They wanted to do what they wanted to do. Okay. Anyway, enough on that.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah, I think the challenge for people to see that is, you know, if you were to look at what people did in the first century and then compare it with what we here do today, it doesn't look the same as far as how they go about doing the same things. And so the journey that's been taken to go from the first century, here's what they did, how they did it, with their current technologies and things they had at their disposal versus what we do today, it doesn't look the same. I mean, now we have, you know, buildings and PowerPoint and phone books and all these other things. And so I think where people struggle is they say, well, we've justified all these other things over time and over history as an expediency. And so they just carry it a little too far and do what you just said. You know, they want to do what they want to do, and they just label it as an expediency without having that deeper dive and really trying to get to the root of what really are we trying, you know, does it support the root of what we're supposed to be doing when we come together?
Yeah, I mean, to make your point, building your point, one of the classical arguments at one point in time in some of these issues was the argument that, well, show me where.
Yeah, where's the building?
Show me where song books are.
Yeah.
No, where's that in the Bible? I don't know. So that's just how it goes back to this fundamental issue we talked about throughout this time. And that's, what's our approach to Scripture? Do we do what's authorized, following what are not Bible rules of interpretation? They're just simple. It's done all the time in English, I mean, in logic. Or are we going to take the approach that as long as it's silent, we're given liberty? Two fundamentally different issues, approaches, attitudes. Okay. So what's the product of all this? By the way, now I'm not going to read all these, but it's just time and time and time again, God uses this terminology about pattern. Follow the pattern. Using the Old Testament with respect to all the things involved in the building of the tabernacle, the elements of the tabernacle, etc., etc. And one of the things when you read all those things, you say, well, they did what God commanded them. Okay, good. But does that mean you have to? Does that mean there's really a pattern there? And I got thinking, you know, you take the ark, which we talked about a moment ago. The ark was to be overlaid with gold, correct? Okay, that's fine. So they do that. And some wise, so smart fellow says, why don't we put, I mean, this is an important piece of equipment. Let's put rubies on it, along with the gold. And that's the way people think, that we're going to add value to it, make it more important by doing this, or more useful, or whatever. Okay, division. What we just mentioned, this business about the disagreement over the silence of the Scriptures, what does that mean? And I think it's insightful when you look at Murch, who was, now this is his view, but I think it's representative of the view that was held. And that is, he says, where the Scriptures speak, we speak, where the Scriptures are silent, we are silent. You've heard that many a time. It became apparent, however, that there was a difference of opinion as to the meaning of this rule. What is a rule? What are rules that we've been talking about?
Creeds.
That's nothing but that view of that is a creed. And, you know, some